With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Back with me today is Dr. Kevin Corbett. Kevin is a UK-based visual artist who has 37 years of nursing experience. As a clinical nurse researcher, he specializes in acute, palliative, and primary medical care, forensics, respiratory, and infectious so-called diseases, including HIV and AIDS, medical screening, and testing. He obtained his master's in science nursing, a master's of science in nursing from King's College London in 1989, and he obtained a PhD in social sciences from London South Bank University in 2001. You can find his website, which includes his writings as well as his artwork, at kevinpcorbett.com. Kevin, welcome back. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me again.
Thank you for inviting me back.
Absolutely. So I encountered two things over the past 2 weeks that compelled me to reach out to you for a conversation. And the first of those included yourself. You and the writer Celia Farber gave a presentation of sorts to the Medical Doctors for COVID Ethics panel, a 3-hour presentation, which I highly recommend people watch if they haven't already. And in that presentation, you and Celia talked about the pseudoscience of virology, but how homing in on what makes virology a pseudoscience, especially in the context of how it's been weaponized against us, not just over the last 3+ years, but for over a century now, how homing in on the flawed or non-existent science that underpins virology is not enough to resist or defeat what has been done to us in terms of the weaponization of illness against us. And you talked about, among other things, the necessity of looking at storytelling, if I can put it that way, and the impact that stories, the impact that framing people, diagnosing them with certain conditions and framing them in a certain way, putting a certain story on them, how that needs to be addressed as well. Because if you address the pseudoscience of virology, which we need to continue doing, it still doesn't get to the emotional toll that's taken, the psychological toll that's taken on people who are victims of the weaponization of illness against us. And so that got me thinking a lot about what I just laid out there. And the second thing I encountered was a very hideous article, which I sent you, which was published at fiercepharma.com on the 7th of June. And it's not so much an article as a call to action for an enterprise that Fierce Pharma is engaged in, titled Biopharma's Collective Memory of COVID in Photographs. Yeah. And it's a call to action for people who work in the so-called biopharma industry to submit photographs and short pieces of writing to contribute to the so-called collective memory of COVID. And again, people can find this at fiercepharma.com and read it for themselves. And perhaps we'll even get into some of it, but it's a way of, to put it mildly, a way of distorting the story of what's happened over the last 3+ years, what's been done to people, and is very much in the vein of what I'd like to speak with you about, the importance mm-hmm. of storytelling, and also in terms of framing people with conditions and putting a story on them, what's known as death making, which the psychologist, the educational psychologist, Wolfensberger, he coined this term in the 70s and wrote a lot about it. And you brought this up in your presentation with Celia. So I'd like to get into all that, but first ask you for your take on the importance of addressing the storytelling aspect of the weaponization of illness.
Well, I think some pretty heavy topics there, but I think that the storytelling's important. I mean, I don't mean to attenuate or dismiss the science arguments. I think they're really important with any phenomenon that's been presented, like COVID or AIDS, as something medical, which I don't think it is really, something else. I think it's really important to have the science critique or science yes. critiques of it. But I think what I was alluding to in that interview or discussion, really, it wasn't really an interview, it was a discussion, was that in itself, that's important. It's a sort of beachhead, but in itself, it doesn't really do everything. It doesn't really stem the evil, as it were. It doesn't really totally push back on it. Only for those people who understand the science critique or familiar with it or the nuances of it. And, you know, science is a very arcane practice or domain, really. And, you know, it doesn't reach everybody. These critiques don't reach everybody. And you've got this massive issue about propaganda, because science is propaganda in today's society, and they're the same. So it's about power at the end of the day. Who has the power to control the narrative, to control the propaganda? This is the sort of Jack Ellul theory of propaganda, and I think he did say in that book from the early 60s on propaganda that science has become propaganda. I think he was right. So I think this is the important area to hone in on. How do you then move forward with the science critique in order to push back? And I think the storytelling, who controls the storytelling, is important. And within this whole fictionalized narrative, that's really important. And the example you've just given of that pharmaceutical website that's trying to develop these narratives around COVID, these fateful narratives of people who've died or the impact on the social sphere, these are quite interesting developments, because they don't just divert or corrupt the narrative, they create and extend and galvanize a certain narrative, the viral narrative, the disease narrative, and they do that through capitalizing on people's emotional and psychological experiences, because undoubtedly people have died with the label of COVID or the label of SARS-CoV-2. We dispute the validity of those labels, but people have died in the last 3 years, as people always do, because death is part of life, and it's part of the everyday, and therefore people have died with those labels attached to them, erroneously, incorrectly, in my view, and in the view of many other scientists. But they have died, and these developments, like this website you mentioned, these initiatives are about galvanizing in the public mindset, in the propaganda, galvanizing the propaganda in the public domain about the validity of these diagnoses, of the science, etc. It's exactly the same as what we had with AIDS. We had the AIDS quilts, which were patchwork quilts woven together. Each quilt, each section of the quilt was dedicated to a person who died, had their name and photograph and dates of birth and details on them. And they were woven
when I was
together
in high school, pardon me for interrupting, when I was in high school, every December, because I believe it was at the time of World AIDS Day, which is December 1st, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Every year around that time when I was in high school, in the auditorium, a quilt would be hung, like the one you just mentioned.
Yeah. And you see, these are, I mean, there was a psychohistorian called Caspar Schmidt who wrote a couple of really important essays on the psychology of the 80s and 90s and the psychology, the mass psychology behind AIDS or underpinning it. And it's not a very well-known essay, but you can find it on the internet. But he said that the quilts were like the Aztec institution of the Tzompantli, which were the pyramid of human skulls, which the gods would look down on to decide when enough victims had been sacrificed. And that, I mean, it's quite a controversial view of the AIDS quilt, but I do think he had something there about the sociological impact of these and what was behind, you know, what's underpinning this, what's undergirding it, the mechanism that's undergirding this. And these calling for photos and people's personal accounts as biomedical staff, because I think this website you mentioned is pharmaceutical, is appealing to people who work in the technical medical industry, tech industry.
It's an industry website.
So it's using their own experiences of lockdown and all the hype and the drama and maybe their own personal impact on their families and their loved ones, the people who died with these disease labels that were false, like COVID-19, and capitalizing on that emotional experience in a way that reaffirms, reiterates, and galvanizes the sort of propaganda narrative. And that's quite evil, really. It's not just a diversion, it's a reiteration, it's a restatement of it in a very powerful way, blending people's experiences into this, you know, meta-narrative of the virus and the disease and people under threat, you know, and the fear factor. And it serves as a sort of public warning then. It's a sort of public symbol that has a sociological impact over and above the what it looks like. It has something, it has a greater impact, it has a synergistic effect. I think that's what Caspar Schmidt was talking about with the AIDS quilt, you know, that these things have a fear factor, they have a wow factor, they have a drama attached to them. They are spectacular, aren't they? They are spectacles in that sense. And they serve that function. They serve many functions, but they serve the function of reiterating the narrative and I think empowering it. And I think that's the issue, going back to what you said about the discussion with Celia on that channel, is this issue about, you know, you have all the science narratives and we have a lot of anti-virology narratives today that are very powerful, and people have done a huge amount of work in the last 3 years. And that's really, really positive. But in addition to that, I think there's something more. There's the psycho-emotional impact of the psycho-emotional analysis that we have about the impact of this, which goes beyond just the lab science and the lack of methodology, the no controls, the whole projective the whole projective sphere of virology, which is about projecting notions of fear and contagion into data and shaping the data around, you know, human constructions of fear and loathing. And I think that Celia's right, that goes beyond just a capital and an analysis of capitalism. It goes to something else. It certainly goes to communistic analysis of politically. So I think that's probably where I would put it. There's something else that's needed other than just the science critique. And mm-hmm. You can see that today because the power that's invested in this is moving forward. You know, you can see reiterations of this. You can see the movement of WHO to try and create a sort of pandemic trigger button globally that can be pushed to create the fear factor in every country. And that, if that doesn't work, then there'll be something else that will be utilized, like climate fear, other fear mechanisms.
And cyber pandemic, as it's been put.
Cyber pandemic, or, you know, and I think maybe there's a lot we need to go back to that we've left behind with this, which is how authority becomes powerful. And I was looking at some of William Burroughs's work the last couple of weeks, the writer, and it's not particularly easy to read for some people, I don't think. But there's something there about this whole concept of virus and about the fear factors that have been triggered with all of this, and the way that you can easily motivate people to become, you know, to turn on each other. Contagion's a very powerful mechanism like that, but I think there are others as well. And there are other mechanisms that are utilized. So,
and to add to that, or to flesh that out a bit, or emphasize that, again, this occurred to me over the last 2 weeks, especially, but what we're talking about here are stories and story making, and the fact that each one of us lives in a story, which is not to say there's no objective reality. I'm not endorsing postmodernism here, but we do experience life through a story that we tell ourselves, or stories that we tell ourselves, and we choose which stories to inhabit. And that's the way it is. I'm not casting judgment on that. And I think that one of the most vital stories we're talking about here is the story of virology, and how, if you look at its origins, if you look at the ontological fallacy that it is, it's a story that's in search of a material entity to justify the existence of the story. And it's never been able to find in a scientific way that material entity. And so I think in the context of story making and storytelling, that people like Drs. Mark and Sam Bailey, for example, are doing excellent work in a storytelling way. In fact, in Mark Bailey's paper, A Farewell to Virology, he points out, in a sense, what I just said, that virology's origins start as a story without a material underpinning of that story, and then the story has since been in search of a material underpinning. Yeah. And we've talked about all the ways that virology has sought to magic up something material to justify itself and has failed.
Yes.
So
it's like, he's absolutely right on that. It's a projection, you see, virologies. It's a projection of a concept. It's a projection of a set of ideas into data again and again. And you can see it. I think Mark, in that paper, went through a lot of this, that from era to era, from different sets, different eras of technology in virology, from the 19th century through to the 21st, again and again, the material basis could never be found. It was fudged, it was approximated, it was a surrogate tested, whatever. But again and again, through all the different iterations of technology, it's just not there. The basis of it wasn't there, was unproven within its own criteria, right up until the 90s. You could see this in the 90s. You had papers where they were saying, where virologists themselves were saying, you know, RNA detection is not equivalent to detecting a virus. We just haven't done it, basically. Hand on their hearts, they're saying, you know, the ones that were moral were saying this, but the ones, the industry had overreach and it was pushing towards ever greater, lack of governance, but ever greater claims of whatever. And it was going beyond its own criteria, going beyond its own domains. Overreach, complete overreach. And that's something to do with the technology itself, like PCR, with its phenomenal claims and the way that it was heroically discussed right from the get-go, I'm afraid, by people like Carrie Mullis, who talked about it in very, very heroic terms. The whole narrative of him discovering it on in his mind on a road journey in America in the 80s, you know, was a scientific heroism, you know, of the great discoverer. And this is part of the problem, you see, with the technology, I think, is it's overreach.
And there's a story in and of itself about the discovery of PCR and projection onto that story of heroism, etc.
Yeah, and then it becomes a way of looking inside the body, as he just talked about it in his book. I can't remember the title of his biography, but it's quite famous. Dancing Naked in the Minefield, isn't it? And he talked about it being able to give you the ability to look inside the body to find HIV that you didn't see before. That's how PCR was valorized and how it was packaged and how it was sold. So all the messiness of it, all the downside of it, the contaminants, the experiments that never added up, all that was sort of sidelined as the 90s came in. And this positive view of it, this valorized view of the technology, gleaming, you know, packaged in machines and test kits, it's performative, it works, it gives you outcomes, outputs. And all of this overtook the downside of it, which was just completely put into the waste bin and not looked at. And there we have, you know, where we are today, 30, 40 years later with it. And that's why one has to have a critical view of these technologies and these mm-hmm. devices that are, they actually black box their own histories. And they become the history associated with becomes like a war, you know, narrative. The winner takes all, and the positive view of it is put forward, and not the downside of it. And it becomes so impossible or difficult to tell people that these technologies have caveats and they don't work and they're only approximations and they're based on models. And I mean, Carey Mullis himself said, you know, it's almost impossible to get a decent sample of DNA from an organism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he said that in an article in Scientific American in 1990, which was his.
And that brings up the story of DNA itself and the human genome itself and what we've been told those are, and how when that's examined deeper beyond the story that we're told, there are a lot of things that that don't hold up. And again, this storytelling aspect appears. And I think that for me, understanding this as part of the weaponization of illness against us is key, because we have to understand what's wrong first before we can try to fix it. And
but I also think that this huge edifice that's been built up around medicine, orthodox medicine, and medical doctors are part of this this persona, this imaginary. They're part of it, whether they like it or not. And that's what makes it quite powerful when these doctors stand out, these medical doctors stand out, and they say, no, this is wrong. The whole basis, the whole epistemology of it is wrong. The fundamental axioms and postulates are all wrong. And that's what makes it quite powerful, I think, very powerful, if people listen to it. And that is the problem, that a lot of people will not engage with these alternative narratives, these alternative stories of what's wrong with science. And unless individuals have had a negative experience of orthodox medicine or the technology, then they won't be receptive to an alternative. If their experience of it has been positive, it seemed to deliver for them, or it's given them some sort of advantage, then they just won't be receptive to the alternative, to the truth. And I've seen that again and again. I saw it with AIDS. I've seen it since, in the last 40 years. So people that have had a wake-up call around their own health, or they've had a test, and you know, an HIV test, and they went along with it, and then they suddenly started questioning it. Something made them question, somebody they spoke to, or something they read, or something about what they've been told didn't add up in their own bodily experiences. The model didn't deliver for them. Then they're open to alternatives, and it's like a door, you know, it's like a chink in the armor. It's an open door, and you can put your foot in. People can then become more receptive to alternatives. And somebody's had indeterminate test results, for example, with, say, an HIV test, will be questioning this. They've been recalled again and again, or they've had alternative test results. They were positive for a while, and they repeated their test, and they found they were negative. Somebody who's had that experience could never go back to accepting the mainstream narrative about HIV, AIDS, or the tests. Generally, they'd be questioning it fundamentally. And how many people who've had these HIV diagnoses never have their tests repeated? They accept the result, you know, and they don't have a second or third opinion, or repeat it again and again and again.
And this goes back to the story we've been told. That we're told
killer virus. Essentially, you've got a killer. You've got a killer virus. You know, that's the
right.
That's the mainstream view of it. You know, wouldn't you want to know that that's correct, or wouldn't you want to have it repeated a few times, or repeated in a few months, or in a year, repeated. You know, I remember talking about stories. I remember working with a physician, and she retested one of the HIV positive patients who was quite well and had good surrogate markers, and the test came back repeatedly negative. This person being positive for over 10 years. And the doctor was, I think she did it after speaking to me, so I'm not sure if it was my fault, but she got into so much trouble from the virologists, and they came down on her like a ton of bricks because she did it without consent. She repeated the test without consent. But the person concerned was quite accepting of it. He said, I always thought it was wrong, and it didn't hold the meaning for me that I'd been led to believe. You know, I've not been unwell, I've been quite well. And I think this is where we're talking about, you know, if everybody could read Farewell to Virology and every biomedical scientist could read it and they could understand it, we'd all be on the same page, to use that awful term. Yeah, so we'd all have an awareness, we'd all be woken up about the lies of virology. That'd be great. That's a utopia. That will never happen at the moment, I think, because of these psychological, emotional impacts. These are this is the unwritten curriculum, the hidden curriculum that we need to address with it, really. How do we get across, you know, the social meanings attached to these tests and to these concepts in virology are so profoundly motivated by certain vested interests that are really intrinsic to the social sphere. And it's getting through those, it's cutting through those that are really important. I mean, I think maybe it's a trite analogy, but you know, you can tell people XYZ isn't good for you. You know, here's the intellectual analysis of why XYZ is not good for your body or good for your health. But people still do XYZ. They'll still take it or they'll still use it or whatever, knowing that this isn't healthy, knowing that there's something wrong with it. And it, that, I mean,
And
you
I
see, you
think
saw,
that's
you saw this with the COVID. You know, people took the injections, they took the jabs, they took the shots. Many people knew, well, there's probably something wrong with it, or it's not good, or, but you know, I need to get around the world for my job, or I need to do this, or I need to go on holiday, or I need to do this, I need to do that. I need to fit in with the social environment. I need to fit in. I don't want to stand out. I don't want to put my head above the parapet. And it was those mechanisms that are more powerful for many people, not necessarily what they knew intellectually. And that's what motivated some people. And I'm talking about, I knew people who were as aware of the caveats of the science as you and I are, and many of the distant scientists. And yet they took the injections, they took it because there were other factors that were more important, that were more motivating, other than just the intellectual knowledge.
Stories that were more powerful, one could say.
More powerful, yeah. And I think
Kevin,
that that's kind
let's,
of important.
pardon me for interrupting again. We need to take a quick break, but I do want to pick up on this afterward. And in terms of storytelling and framing people with conditions and understanding this as part of the problem we need to address, I'd like to talk about death making, which you've talked about previously, as I mentioned earlier, and how this has not only been going on for the last 3+ years, but for well before that, and how that sort of, it's not just storytelling, it's, as you talked about, it's these psychosocial projections really that are placed onto people, or categorizations or characterizations that are placed onto people, which are stories in a sense, but they're part of this allopathic weaponry system we're talking about. And so I'd like to to talk about death making, because it seemed to have gained in popularity late last century, and it's not much talked about today, but I think it's more relevant than ever. So let's pick up on that after a short pause. So everybody please hang tight, and I will be right back with Kevin Corbett here on TNT Radio after this.
You should hear what David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan are talking about.
You were born in Ukraine.
Yes.
So the idea that you're a Russian asset is a bit ridiculous. Doesn't mean people wouldn't say it. So tell us about the reservoir. Yeah, I want to pick your brains for all the inside information you have.
It's not quite big on a generating of electricity, but that provide a necessary level of water. And it's also was from this area that was a channel was provide entire water supply to Crimea. First of all, why they blow the dam? We heard for like a 6 months about great and beautiful big Ukrainian counteroffense was supposed to clear and liberate Ukrainian territories out of Russian occupation, and it's still not happening. It's not happening. But suddenly, on the night of June 4, it started happening, and Ukrainians, of course, was taking a huge casualties and achieving very little results, and they needed destruction, and that destruction was a dam. Why they did it and how we can expose them? This is very interesting.
McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
This is Jesse Zerowell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zerowell, and I'm speaking with Dr. Kevin Corbett, who is joining me from the UK. Kevin, in 1987, Wolf Wolfensberger, who was an educational psychologist who passed in 2011, he published a book called The New Genocide of Handicapped and Afflicted People. And one of, well, the book focuses on the fact that in, and this is coming from the description of the book itself, in contemporary Western societies, there is both increasing support for and increasing practice of death makings of many classes of devalued people. Mm. The book explains that there are both direct forms of death making, such as intentional violence, medicalized abortions, the administration of poison, as in some secret killings in hospitals, etc., but also indirect forms, such as denying people access to needed health care, separating people from family and other community, which leaves them without help and protectors, imposing a dead or dying role on people, and doing things which destroy a person's will to live. And we've seen, not just over the last 3+ years, but for a century now, I would argue, we've seen this carried out, this death making. And this is a form of storytelling, a form of story making, a form of framing that is placed on to people to do all sorts of things to them, to weaponize their health against them for whatever the ends might be for those involved. Mm-hmm. So this is something I know that you're quite well versed in. So can you talk about this and how this fits into what we've been talking about throughout this conversation?
Well, it is a form of storytelling. It's a form of, in healthcare, it's a form of euthanasia. It's used as a form of euthanasia because it affects life chances, and it predetermines based on a notion or an idea of somebody that they fit into a certain group, category, or diagnostic category, or population group, and therefore they should be treated in a certain way. And it's part of, I think, evidence-based medicine today, really, where you've got categorization, you've got classification of people into diagnostic groups, and you treat them according to a protocol. And those protocols are seen to expand people's choices, but they also limit them as well. And I mean, Wolfensberger talked about this initially. His theories were to do with normalization of people with learning disabilities in society. So it's part of this thrust of deinstitutionalization and moving people out of institutions into everyday society. And then he realized that part of this process was a lot at the edges, was this process of death making, where people were being devalued by perceptions, really. And it was perceptions of these individuals with learning disabilities that were the problem. These social perceptions were leading the institutions and the systems and the healthcare systems to delimit people's chances to actually curtail, because they were coming from a position of being devalued from a priority from the get-go. And this is exactly what happened with AIDS. You've had risk groups of people that were predetermined risk groups, and people were fitted into these, or fitted up, I would say, a bit like police fit you up for a crime. And then, you know, it was self-fulfilling prophecy. And you had this right from the get-go with the CDC in America, right from the beginning of investigating AIDS, where they were working with this idea that homosexual, gay, equals diseased, equals contagious. And that shaped the whole of the epidemiology right from the early 80s of AIDS around a virus concept, around certain groups being infectious and being diseased and all the rest of it, playing into all these tropes, all these social fears and social understandings, which are all erroneous and based on fear and prejudice, basically prejudice. And that shaped the whole thing. And that's death-making, absolutely. And the only person really that I've seen who's really uncovered this was a geographer called Michelle Cochrane in her book, Where AIDS Began, published by Routledge in 1996. And she went into how the epidemiology had been built around these perceptions and hardwired this death-making from the get-go. And it's a very good book, and I totally recommend people to get it. Where she is today, I don't know. If she's listening to this program, could she please get in touch? Because I've quoted her book and I've sent it to so many different people. I'd love to have a conversation with her, because she's probably the only academic researcher who worked in, you know, public health and academia who knows what's happened with this and how it was all built around fear and these perceptions. So yes, I think this is, but it's not just AIDS, it's not just contagious diseases, it's everywhere. If you get a cancer diagnosis or palliative care diagnosis, these perceptions of you being devalued will go ahead of will go ahead of you, and they will shape the opportunities you're offered. They'll shape the perceptions of the people treating you, and maybe something that you, maybe not much you can do about that except come away from it or try and fight it in a certain way. And this has been researched in palliative care as well. There was a book in the last few years, last 10 years, on palliative care and social valorization theory, which is the Wolfensperger theory, and about how people are being treated within a model of hospice care that devalues them. And this whole notion that you have to have these sorts of services if you're dying or you've got some sort of terminal condition is again another another system of death making, as though people have never died outside institutions before. Or it's like pregnancy, you know, changing the topic there, but the whole idea of technologically mediated pregnancy and childbirth is again another institutional framework that's been totally pushed back on. So I think that these are very, this death making is a very applicable concept right through lots of areas that we've been looking at in the last 20, 30 years, not just
healthcare. And of course we saw this glaringly, or we've seen it and we continue to see it glaringly with what I call the COVID operation, wherein you have somebody present to the hospital for,
yeah,
let's say,
well, you had somebody presenting with maybe some sort of symptom, and it was automatically presumed that they were, you know, had this killer virus, and they were then put into a program, a protocol, were treated under a protocol, which ended up very quickly with ventilation, with intubation and ventilation in 2020, 2021. And there's a lot of evidence to show that that was death making.
Right. And what we must ask, what created that? And I would argue that it was the story that was created out of a fictional so-called virus and a fictional so-called disease caused by said fictional so-called virus. And the story came first, and that's what stuck in most people's minds first. And you can go back to the paper, or it's an article actually published in the New England Journal of Medicine on June 24th of 2020, a novel coronavirus from patients with pneumonia in China, 2019. And you can see in this article how they're simply looking at patients who are presenting with pneumonia and creating a story from the pneumonia diagnosis, which is a condition, bacterial, I would dispute, but pneumonia is a condition caused by toxicity in the respiratory system. And they're creating a story that this isn't just pneumonia, it's pneumonia caused by a quote novel coronavirus unquote. And that story generated the global terror in people, the worldwide terror. And it led people to, and then of course the stories that arose from people dying of so-called COVID-19, and these were inventions, these were stories. And all of this to point out that what we're dealing with here, and again, not just in an abstract form, and certainly not in a postmodernist, there's no truth form, but story undergirds so much of what we're talking about here.
And I would say that as much as virology is a projective practice, it's projecting notions of contagion and unseen agencies, it's projecting those concepts into data, the story that's knitted together from that is an epidemiological one. And epidemiology is a way of inventing stories through associations, through linkages that are totally contestable and fake, absolutely fake. And that's that paper you mentioned, the one about so-called novel coronavirus, all those sorts of papers are narratives, stories that are epidemiologically created. So they're created through this idea of associations. So these people all got ill at the same time. It's not always the case. And that is linked, those linkages are created to foster the notion of contagion. So you have people approaching services or people with illnesses or symptoms that are not similar, they're quite dissimilar, but those are attenuated, those are forgotten, those are diluted, the differences, and the similarities are played up, and building up this notion of linkages. This is exactly what epidemiology does. Virology is not a science, it's a fake discipline. Epidemiology is something else. Epidemiology builds the fear factor, yeah, because it creates this idea of geographical location and similarity across populations where there's dissimilarity. And I think that as much as we focused on virology, I think there should be a much greater focus on epidemiology, because it's fake, it's false. And so many scientists have said this right back to the 80s, Ivan Illich. And in the 80s you had, and in the 90s you had Peter Skrabanek in his book, The Death of Humane Medicine, was calling out this risk factor epidemiology, calling out the way modern epidemiology creates fake links, false links, like mm-hmm. correlations that are, you know, totally spurious.
It serves to homogenize populations. Yes. And say, look, we're all the same. We're all susceptible to yes. this. It might be on different levels depending on where yes. you are geographically, but the bottom line is, this is coming for all of us.
Mm, exactly. And I think that's why I mentioned the Michelle Cochrane book, because she used that analysis of the AIDS epidemiology in the early 80s to deconstruct it and to show that they went into the field with these ideas that gay men, homosexuals were diseased, and that shaped the whole thing. That shaped the whole paradigm that they're working in. And that's what death making is. It's working with people that might have symptoms or may be ill or dying with prejudiced views of them being devalued, sometimes without even knowing that you have those views. Because nobody right. goes into healthcare to hurt people. Ostensibly, people go into healthcare to help people. But it's an inversion that happens, and people are doing the wrong thing, thinking they're doing the right thing.
Right. So we're up to time, but I'll just end by saying that it's vital that we look at the stories we're being told and the stories we choose to inhabit, and very carefully examine how they comport with reality. That is to say, what we know to be true, and then to act accordingly. And to never accept a story somebody tells us at face value, which should go without saying nowadays, but it's still a very difficult task for a lot of people, and I don't exempt myself from that. So,
well, I think
Kevin,
all,
30,
I think,
sec- 30 yeah. seconds left, yeah. 30 seconds left, and I'd like to give that 30 seconds to you.
I think what I would say to go along with that is that whatever story you adopt, there are implications and ramifications for that story for you and for the wider social sphere that you're in. So to examine those implications and ramifications are important, and to critically examine them rather than passively adopt them.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. Kevin Corbett, thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation. I think it's a very important one, and I'm already looking forward to our next discussion, which I hope is sooner rather than later. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that is all for me for today. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. Stay tuned for Joe Hawk up next here on TNT Radio. And as always, take care.